Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I think I've gotten to a place, and again, you always preach what you need to hear. I'm sure because I've lived a lot of my life trying to figure out how to be in proximity to God, not to lose my sense of proximity to God. Where do I need to go to get to God, and you know, like all that. And I've just really come to believe that all of it is nonsense. If it is, you know, if anything like this notion of God is true at all, that God exists, then there is no way that anybody is separate from God's presence. We might behave in ways that cut ourselves off from ourselves. We might numb our own capacity to feel, like whatever. But the idea of being cut off from God, or sometimes we're warmer, sometimes we get a little closer, and sometimes we're not. Like it just can't be true. And I feel like where I hope that'll be a liberating message for people, especially, is I just feel like we end up wasting a lot of time, a lot of energy, bandwidth, trying to figure out if we're in the right place. Am I on the right path? Am I doing the right thing? Because as defined as, is this where God wants me to be? Am I close to God, away from God, or whatever? What I love even about the Emmaus Road story that I draw so much from is this whole question of where is God on the road that you're walking? Let's just get past the whole like, is no, God is there. David's whole, if I make my bed in hell, take on the wings of the morning, fly the most parts. Like, God is there. Let's get past that and get to where is God on the road that you're already walking in ways that you've not yet recognized. To me, that's a far more interesting question. And I really do believe it. I really do believe that God is wherever you are. And which, hey, that doesn't even mean, right? I mean, all of us at some points in our lives, we can be less healthy than others. Doesn't mean that there's nothing about myself that I might think, oh, I might objectively might want to change this. This is because I want my relationships to be healthier or whatever. But none of that ever needs to be motivated by trying to get closer to God. So I just think, like, if we can clear the debris of that out of the way, the air gets a whole lot cleaner faster.
Spirit unbound, it is the truest form of love that I have found.
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson, and welcome. If you're new here, we are glad that you found us and that you're here. A few things before we get to this week's guest. For all things Deconstructionist Podcast related, visit www.thedeconstructionists.com. There you can link to us on social media, read our blog, listen to every single one of our 140 plus episodes. Yeah, I know it's hard to believe. Snag a pint glass, coffee mug, or t-shirt from our web store, or support us on Patreon. Speaking of Patreon, we know it's been a little quiet over there as of late, and we apologize for that, but that's because we are hard at work on retooling it with new packages and exclusive content. So lots to come there. So stay tuned for that, and we'll give you more on that as we are ready to kind of relaunch it. So more to come. If you enjoy the podcast, though, consider leaving a 5-star review on iTunes and telling a friend. Word of mouth is our bread and butter. And of course, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single new episode. All right. This week's guest is a returning guest, Jonathan Martin. Last time I talked to him, it was right at the start of the pandemic when we were all in lockdown. And so it was nice to get to chat with him again. Jonathan is a good friend of the podcast, brilliant preacher, has his own podcast as well called Zeitgeist, and is an amazing author as well, which is why we sat down to talk again. He has a new book coming out called The Road Away from God, How Love Finds Us Even As We Walk Away. It's literally the book I would have written had I ever had the desire to write a book about all the different conversations and experiences that I've had through doing this podcast for the last 6 years. So it really is just a perfect book, and he really addresses a lot of the things a lot of us have gone through or are going through. Jonathan is a writer, poet, and speaker who has undergone his own experience of finding God on the underside of life. Wherever he goes, his message is always the same. No matter who you are, where you've been, or what you've done, God is at work to bring beauty out of your brokenness. He has a master's of theology from Duke University and a master's from the Pentecostal Theological Seminary. He currently lives in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, where he serves as pastor of The Table and, of course, as I said, the host of the great podcast Zeitgeist. We just had a really, really fun conversation, really brought, you know, gave me a lot of life and a lot of joy, and I think it did for him as well. So hopefully you can feel that in the conversation as you listen to it. But it was just a lot of fun, as it always is, when I get together. That was hard to say, with Jonathan. And so, so here it is. So I'll get out of the way and let you guys listen to it. It's pretty fun and fantastic. So enjoy. And without further ado, I give you Jonathan freaking Martin.
What matters most as the lights go out and I swim towards the coast. Love of life, spirit
unbound. All right, Jonathan Martin, welcome back to the Deconstructionist Podcast.
Thank you, friend. It's so good to be back. I'm such a huge fan of the podcast, as you know. Love the show. And this would be the first, I have some coming up, but this is the first podcast I've done about the book yet. So this is like the premiere. Hey. I love that. So right. Really, really good to be back.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you so much. And had a blast with you last time. And it's kind of crazy. The world is kind of topsy-turvy. And we spoke, I think we did our interview probably right before the pandemic really kicked into high gear. I think it was in the initial stages. And here we are, like 2 years later, you know. Things are still weird for different reasons, but we seem to be finally coming out of this, at least the kind of isolated quarantine version of the pandemic, and sort of getting back to some semblance of normalcy.
Yes, which I'm very grateful for. And it's kind of it's so interesting even writing and all that during that, because you kind of feel like the book is coming into a world that's different than the one that existed when I was writing it. So that's kind of a weird feeling, you know. It's like that everything's changed so much. My life has changed so much, like everybody's had. And right now feels like such an ambiguous time. It's just...
Yeah, a lot of unknowns, it feels like. You know, we've got the conflict, the war going on, you know, between Russia and Ukraine, and there's all sorts of, you know, as always, political things happening. And you know, the pandemic, you know, isn't completely over. There's, you know, obviously the virus is still out there and mutating. And yeah, it just seems very kind of unsettled, I would say.
For sure. Yeah. It's,
yeah.
Sorry,
so,
go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just, go ahead.
Oh, no, I just, it does feel it feels unsettled out there, which makes it feel unsettled in here. And, I think that's part of, I feel like that's basically everybody I know right now. It's like, I can't think of anybody who feels a sense of stability right now. I think there's, you know, just in an exterior way, there's just too much that's still shaking for anybody to feel too calm. If people are too calm right now, then it makes me nervous. It'd be like, I don't know what's wrong with you. You feel like too, feel too okay right now.
Right. I think at that point you've pretty much boxed yourself in and you're ignoring the outside at that point.
That's,
you know,
kind of just head in the sand.
You're paying attention. Well, tell me a little bit about the creative process behind the book, because as a creative person, which obviously you are, you know, a lot of people who are, you know, what you might call creatives found this kind of lockdown period as kind of a way to, like, all right, I'm locked in my house. What else am I going to do? And they found it to be kind of a silver lining in terms of like being able to be creative and start putting some thoughts together and figure out what their next project was going to be. So was that sort of the deal with this book?
Yes and no. I really experienced all that in phases. And I think I'm the kind of person that for me, all of that has meant being cut off from any external sources of energy. And when I get in my head, I get sort of dark and it's bad for me creatively. So I feel like even though I love being alone, and, you know, I think like most writers are, I feel like it's taken me kind of a long time to find rhythm again, which I feel like I'm there now. Now, actually, I feel like it's sort of drinking from a fire hydrant. I want to sort of, I feel like I could write 18 books in the next year in the groove that I'm in now. But it took a long time to get there. I feel like there was a long kind of desolate lull where I felt like I couldn't, almost feel like I couldn't do anything. Like maybe because, and I don't know if that's like a pastoral gene or something, but I feel like I get so much from the electricity of other people and being connected with other people's lives in a meaningful way. And in some ways being cut off from that, it's like you sort of lose your reasons a bit. And so, yeah, I feel like I'm not one of those people actually that felt like, that kind of has flourished creatively through all this. It kind of went the opposite direction.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I was listening to, there's a new podcast I discovered. It's hosted by Dana Carvey and Jordan Spade. And I grew up, it's really good. It's called Fly on the Wall. And of course they use their connections to interview all these different, friends of theirs that many of which, you know, have either, been a cast member on Saturday Night Live mm-hmm. or, you know, had been hosts or at some point. And it's really interesting because they were talking the other day, about the pandemic and how it impacted their work. Cause obviously for a time mm-hmm. they couldn't go out and perform before live audiences. And it was interesting. I think one of them had mentioned that he found it as a time to really dig in and start to go through mm-hmm. material and work through new material. And the other was complete opposite. Yeah. You know, he said, I feel like I should have taken more advantage of it, but I just basically just watched movies with my kids.
Right,
you know?
Sure.
So, like, it's interesting to see the different approaches to it. I haven't mentioned the title of the book. I should probably do that. The Road Away from God, How Love Finds Us Even As We Walk Away. Great book, first of all. Like you're such a tremendous writer. Very poetic in the way that you kind of use words as a vehicle. And I found it hitting on exactly the things and the themes and topics that when Adam was still part of the podcast, when you know we used to talk about between the two of us and with our guests throughout the years. So many moments I found you just nailing it, just hitting the nail on the head. So what inspired you to write about this topic specifically?
Well, thank you so much for the kind words. You know, I realize even as we start to talk about it, what a vulnerable feeling it is, because it's actually weird how few people have actually read this. I mean, besides the handful of endorsers, it's just not many people have read this material. So it's just that very like, I don't know. And I think because for me, the pandemic did feel like a time of largely being off the scene. It's like, oh, you're throwing this thing out in the world, not knowing where it's going to land with anybody. So I'm glad any of it, you know, has resonated with your experience. I think the process for me was twofold. One is that it's very much my own journey. It's very much me. I mean, I feel like you always preach what you need to hear. So processing my own disillusionment, my own, which, you know, I know I wrote a book called How to Survive a Shipwreck, but to me, these books are nothing alike. I mean, that book was very much about grief, loss, failure kind of at large. This is a very particular book about dealing with, themes anywhere from kind of religious trauma to just finding reasons to believe, especially when people are disillusioned by institutional systems and faith systems and that kind of thing. Which I think is a really particular kind of pain. So a lot of it was me processing that, but it's also coming alongside a lot of people who've been on that journey too. So really for me, it's like anything that I write, it's always me working those things through. It was interesting actually, because a lot of the content earlier in the book has existed for kind of a long time. I feel like those things have just kind of been alive in me for a while in terms of like the germ of the ideas, at least. But it was interesting, even like writing the back end of it, how much of it, like I really didn't know where it was going to go until I got there. Like it really, you know, like this whole, it was a very much a live question, even this, okay, is it possible to come back home? Is it possible to find a sense of home again? It was like something I was honestly trying to figure out in the writing, without having a sense of expectation of where the process was going to lead me. It really was me working a thing out as opposed to, okay, I feel like I've come to this conclusion that I want to share with people. It's more like, you know, it's much more personal for me than that.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool. For those who are listening who didn't listen, who haven't heard our first interview together, should go back and listen to that. But you talked about, you had this idea kind of bouncing around in your head about just the symbolic nature and what it really meant, the part of the crucifixion story in the aftermath where the disciples are walking away from Jerusalem, and what that really kind of spoke to you. And you really expand on it in the book in such a cool way that I think really helps kind of understand our relationship with God, but also helps kind of explain the journey that so many of us find ourselves on. And I thought that was just exceptionally cool how you were able to really kind of use that as a way of saying, look, you know, we're never alone, even when we think we are.
Yeah. I so appreciate that, friend.
So tell me a little bit about, I want to start at the beginning of the book, obviously, logical place to start, I suppose. Early on in the book, you compare the loss of belief to a type of grief or grieving, like the loss of a loved one or the loss of a relationship. I think that is something that a lot of my listeners identify with. It certainly is a type of grief and loss and mourning, because so often, you know, it's not just a loss of maybe belief or some of your beliefs, but it's also oftentimes severing relationships, you know, and community. And it's so much more than just, I don't believe this particular thing anymore. Oftentimes you lose friendships and relationships. So talk about, you know, that type of grief and grieving and what that means.
Well, I don't want to overstate it, but in a lot of ways, I think I've come to believe it's the deepest kind of grief, because I don't know any way that you can lose belief or a belief system. And as much as we might want to say there's a difference, I think oftentimes our belief often, you know, does come via some sort of a system without losing your identity. I mean, the constellation of relationships that we have, that's how we know who we are, is who people tell us that we are. And we might like to think that we have a more deeply formed self than that, but at the end of the day, who we are to other people, that's how we know ourselves. So then when you start to change your mind, and then other people change how they relate to you, and you realize that the very foundations of your existence don't really exist in the same way anymore. I mean, that's just, then all of a sudden everything's up in the air. You're in outer space. So I think in some ways it's, and I think that's where for a lot of people have been and continue to be, like, surprised at how deep and long that grieving process really is, because you keep finding out all these other ways that your life and your identity was tied to, okay, it's really not as simple as I used to believe this thing about this Bible verse, and now I don't, and now I'm a little more open or something. No, it's kind of this whole nexus of relationships and that nourished you, that really were maybe actually had been life-giving at one point before. Because I think that's the thing that can't be, that I can't say strongly enough, is I definitely don't see it as starkly as, if it were, maybe it would be less painful. All these things that that people thought were true suddenly turn out to be all of it are lies. Well, not really. Or I think for most people it's not. It's much more complex. It's like, well, there are some things, some experiences that were beautiful you might want to hold on to, but you don't know how to. Other things that do turn out to be like deeply like, oh, okay, that really was bad and seems really impossible to know how to sort, which also makes the grieving more complicated, because you're not even sure exactly which things you're supposed to be grieving, or that you have permission to grieve, or you give yourself permission to grieve. So, I think the fact that it's such an ambiguous process really makes the grief deeper and worse, you know, not better.
Yeah. And one of the things that you talk about too, that I think is so prevalent and oftentimes the thing that pushes people out of, some of these expressions of Christianity is, you know, a lot of these expressions, specifically within in America and North America, I guess, are expressions of Christianity that are really built on this house of shame and guilt. And then, you find as you're leaving those expressions of Christianity, you talk about the fact that all the voices around you are kind of, you know, pushing the guilt and the shame on you, because now they're saying, well, this path that you're on is the wrong one, or, you know, you're backsliding, or this is, you know, whatever the case is. And it just kind of, that cycle of guilt and shame just kind of continues.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's so self-perpetuating. It's like, so, you know, the very fact that, because those voices become very, so deeply internalized that then in the very act of moving away, you know, even when we think we've changed our minds, I think like on a cellular level, the whole, you know, your body keeps the score kind of idea. Really, we keep feeling that. And then every time you continue to move in a direction that's not the direction you were moving before and something goes wrong, then you assume it's your fault. And this must be God punishing me because I'm not the wrong path. And, you know, so it kind of prepares. So it kind of becomes this, it kind of, that thesis keeps validating itself. And I think that's real. I don't feel like I've had a lot of conversations about that with folks. I feel like that's a very real phenomenon, that life is going to continue to be hard regardless of what you believe. But if you change courses, then now there's all this ammunition to assume that the reasons that things are hard is because you haven't done things the right way.
Yeah. And what's interesting too, is you hear so often from people who are still kind of within that construct, that for anyone who's left that expression of Christianity, well, you don't like the fact that, well, for example, hell, you know, you don't like the fact that hell exists. So you're just picking and choosing what you want to believe and creating your own version of Christianity. I'm like, well, no, because if you really dig deep enough and study, you know, in context, you know, then some of these things don't really hold up as well anymore.
Mm-hmm. That's so true, John. This is one of the things that, in terms of a catalyst for writing at all or think this way. And, I mean, it's fraught, you know, with all kinds of challenges, but it's one of the reasons I feel like I have to keep swinging on this in some way. It's, you know, I feel like we're constantly told, both by people who believe and people who no longer believe, what Christianity is, in ways that just to my bones, I just don't believe it's true. I just don't believe it's true. I don't believe eternal conscious torment is true. I don't think it's in Scripture. I don't think anything like it is in Scripture. But I feel like, you know, whether folks are super evangelical or sometimes they might be very ex-evangelical, are going to say in some form, this is what the Bible says. I don't believe it's what the Bible says. And so part of what I feel like it's not an apologetic or something, but that I'm trying to contend for is, here is, you know, here is God as I see it. Here is a more beautiful Christianity, the way that I see it. Not that everybody has to see it that way. And that's a line I really try to walk carefully in the book, is I really don't want it to be preachy. The idea is not trying to say that if you want to reject Christianity or reject Jesus, that you can't and that God's going to make you anyway. It's much softer than that. It's much more like, no, I mean, if God really is love, then love goes with you, whatever you think about love. And if God actually isn't punitive, then you don't have to be concerned that because you've changed your mind about God, that God's going to come back and, you know, and get you. I still happen to believe in the God that's revealed in Jesus. And I'm not staying up late at night worried about other people's souls, et cetera. But, you know, again, there's just a lot of people, both who believe and who've rejected belief, who want to kind of define, to say that, like, this is what Christianity is. This is what Scripture is, in ways that I just truly just don't, I just don't find resonant.
Well, and it's interesting too, because we continue to, out of one side of our mouth, preach about this God of love who we see through the character of Jesus. But at the same time, you know, we still kind of, out of the other side of our mouths, kind of preach this idea that God is this vengeful, you know, scorekeeper, you know, and it's like, we've learned from history, you know, I've said this before, I think on the podcast, that, you know, this fear tactic just doesn't work. We've seen it with governmental systems where, you know, you have this tyrannical ruler, and sure, it keeps the people in check, but the second they have to overthrow you, they're taking you out. Like, that's not a change of heart. That's just keeping people in check, you know, through power and through fear and that sort of thing. And that's not the God that I see in the Bible, nor the God that I believe in.
But I love how you put it, John. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work. It doesn't work in any relationship. No, there is no relationship that works when you've got your gun to somebody's head. It's not even a relationship. It's actually not a relationship. So it's, I mean, that's part of the deal. You know, for people that still kind of contend for that sort of perspective, it's like, hey, it never produces good fruit in people's lives. It doesn't make people more loving. I don't think make people more disciplined. It just makes people more repressed and more afraid. So I just love the way you put that. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work as a way of life.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the other things too, that you touched on that I absolutely loved, I've been saying this for years. Like, so I grew up as a good little Lutheran boy. And so my experience was very, very different than a lot of my friends who grew up, you know, in more of an evangelical, expression of Christianity so this phrase that I kept hearing was new to me. And this phrase was, and it was always, in the context of some sort of behavior modification, right? So like they would say, well, you know, that thing that you're doing is just, it's just separating you from God. And I kept saying, that doesn't even make any sense. Yeah. I'm like, where could you possibly go that God isn't? And you talk about that in the book. There's this quote that I freaking love that I'm going to share right now. I'm going to quote you to you. just cause I think people need to hear it. You said, you say, God, as it turns out, is where you are. And if where you are is where God is, then where you are is right where you're supposed to be. And I think that's, first of all, profound in that sense. But also when we've talked about kind of the journey, you can call it a deconstruction. Some people hate that word. I get it. We don't even love the word. Just call it a spiritual journey or, you know, whatever you want to call it. But we always saw it as a path as well and kind of likened it to Joseph Campbell when he talks about the hero's journey. And so I love the visual imagery of a path. And you put it so perfectly when you talk about, you know, being on the path feels oftentimes, and you relate this to the biblical story we were referencing at the top. Sometimes it feels like you're walking away when in fact you're right where you are supposed to be. So talk about that. I thought that was,
well, perfect. I so appreciate that. You know, I think I've gotten to a place, and you know, again, you always preach what you need to hear. I'm sure because I've lived a lot of my life trying to figure out how to be in proximity to God, not to lose my sense of proximity to God. Where do I need to go to get to God, and you know, like all that. And I've just really come to believe that all of it is nonsense. If it is, you know, if anything like this notion of God is true at all, that God exists, then there is no way that anybody is separate from God's presence. We might behave in ways that cut ourselves off from ourselves. We might actually numb our own capacity to feel, like whatever. But the idea of being cut off from God, or sometimes we're warmer, sometimes we're a little closer, and sometimes we're not, like it just can't be true. And I feel like where I hope that'll be a liberating message for people, especially, is I just feel like we end up wasting a lot of time, a lot of energy, bandwidth, trying to figure out if we're in the right place. Am I on the right path? Am I doing the right thing? Because as defined as, is this where God wants me to be? Am I close to God, away from God, or whatever? What I love even about the Emmaus Road story that I draw so much from is this whole question of, where is God on the road that you're walking? Let's just get past the whole, like, is no, God is there. David's soul, if I make my bed in hell, take on the wings of the morning, fly the most parts. Like, God is there. Let's get past that and get to, where is God on the road that you're already walking in ways that you've not yet recognized? To me, that's a far more interesting question. And I really do believe it. I really do believe that God is wherever you are. And, which, hey, that doesn't even mean, right? I mean, all of us at some points in our lives, we can be less healthy than others. Doesn't mean that there's nothing about myself that I might think, oh, I might objectively might want to change this. This is because I want my relationships to be healthier or whatever. But none of that ever needs to be motivated by trying to get closer to God. So I just think, like, if we can clear the debris of that out of the way, the air gets a whole lot cleaner faster.
Yeah. And using that story, you have this powerful observation where you talk about the fact that the disciples, you know, looking at the crucifixion, it kind of fractured or destroyed this safe place that they had. You know, Jesus was always there, was teaching them through parables, and now Jesus is gone. And you kind of liken it to, you know, when the temple was destroyed, there was this physical place where they could go and feel safe, and now it's gone. And so you compare that to, you know, modern day, like perhaps you grew up in a church and that was your safe place and suffered some, you know, religious trauma, and suddenly that illusion is, you know, shattered, and that's not your safe place anymore. And so I thought that was really powerful. So talk about that a little bit, and, you know, losing your sense of safety and hope through an experience like that.
Well, it's, you know, when I was writing that chapter in particular, there were a couple things that were really important to clarify. One, I didn't want to minimize how important those safe spaces are, like almost mythologically to us. They're a really big deal. And even we talk about how painful and the kind of grief of the loss of belief, losing those places. Oh my goodness. Ooh. Like a place that all your life has been identified with a sense of home spiritually. There's community here that cares. And all of a sudden now you're at a place in your life where you drive by it and every nerve in your body is screaming. That is a horrible, horrible feeling. And the thing about it is, I really do believe that sacred spaces are incredibly important and can serve a beautiful function. So what I don't want to say, because I really don't believe that, is that consecrated spaces can't be good or important. I think the whole idea of consecrated spaces are, okay, you set aside this space. I think same idea with like a consecrated meal, that, I mean, even Eucharist. I feel like the grand idea is that it teaches how to appreciate and be grateful for all meals. And I think the same thing about sacred space. We learn how to honor one space so that, big picture wise, we're learning how to honor every space that we're in. So I don't think the idea of sacred spaces is bad. And it's kind of like, well, we have the woods. Why would anybody need a sacred space? No, sacred spaces can be good. The trouble with sacred spaces is that too often the idea becomes, this is the only space where God is. If you're not in this space, then God's not with you. If you're not here where our people are, then you're outside the will of God. God can't go with you when you're outside those doors. And that becomes incredibly damaging for people. So I think so that's part of what I, you know, was trying to manage in that chapter. It's like, yeah, these spaces are really beautiful. And I think part of, you know, that cycle that we're on is trying to find ways to redeem good things that happen in some of those spaces, even if we don't feel like they're necessarily where we belong anymore. What could it look like to have new sacred spaces, have safe places again that might be healthy for us? But at the end of the day, a lot of us don't feel welcome in some of the places that we came from. So the idea of going back to them and existing in them the way that we did before, it's just not an option, realistically.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it, you know, really comes down to your personal experience and what led you to ending up on the path in the first place. And you talk about that too, just like the different things. And we've discussed it on this podcast for years, you know, and gotten lots of emails. I almost said letters. I'm like, no one sends letters anymore. It's emails. I'm dating myself there. But gotten lots of emails from people and been fortunate. I've talked to people in person and they kind of all share, they want to share their experience. How did I end up on this journey? And oftentimes it's from a place of trauma, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But so talk a little bit about how does one find themselves on kind of this journey?
Well, almost never by choice. I think it's great when people
right.
do. And occasionally that happens. I think that somebody, you know, they just read books and go on some journey of discovery and think, I don't think I want to do this anymore. I want to go kind of on a different path. I just think that's normally not how it works. I think normally those spaces are so important to us and have almost kind of such a primal significance to our being that we don't leave until we feel forced out, until it just doesn't seem tenable anymore. And so I think that can happen from anything from a crisis of trust someone that was an authority figure that we looked up to, something happens where that sense of, like, of trust is broken. I think it can happen from something as basic as, here are the people who told me these basic facts about science or about sexuality. Now I've come to see those things differently. So now what do I believe about this whole set of beliefs that I was given? That, I mean, maybe that's extreme version, but that may, that might have started with the idea that the earth is 6,000 years old, like whatever. What the, I've always believed that all the answers I got here were good and right. I there's no kind of getting around it, even though I didn't want to make the whole book about this. 2016, a lot of things changed for a lot of people, not because I think the world fundamentally changed in some way, but I just think a lot of things that were already there were just kind of exposed. And so we're a lot of, so all of a sudden, people who might have already been on some kind of a journey theologically, politically, so, you know, how they think about social issues or whatever was already steering. And now they're hearing from a pulpit that they can't, that that journey's not okay, that to be a real Christian is to be this or to be that. It felt like kind of prior to 2016, there was a lot of kind of don't ask, don't tell. There was sort of room to explore different ways to think about Christianity around the fringes, where all of a sudden that was kind of taken away. And now it's like, there's a lot of like trying to uproot people who don't think like us. I really think that's been true for so many people. It's been interesting how many people I've talked to who I think would have stayed in certain kind of institutions or faith systems if it would have been an option at all. But it got so intense and it became so clear that, like, if you to stay here is to be with us 100% and all these things. And, you know, or down to literally, like, you better, you've got to sign the faith statement that you're with us and you are for us or you're against us. So it just, you know, it just wasn't an option to even be exploring things anymore, to still be figuring it out. That just wasn't a possibility.
Yeah, I think that's clearly one of the biggest issues, right? Like, it's this idea, this notion that you can't question anything. And that one person's interpretation is the one and only correct one. And if that were true, we wouldn't have, 45,000 different expressions of Christianity in North America alone. It's this kind of ridiculous idea that any one person has everything figured out. I mean, the Bible is filled with ambiguity, you know, and probably for good reason in a lot of sections. But, you know, we've been struggling and wrestling with this as Christians for, you know, thousands of years now.
Absolutely.
So you make this point in the book. You talk about the fact that nobody ever really bonds over piety, but we do bond over shared pain. And in the act of naming your sorrow to another person who's sharing in that experience and kind of like leaving the church, you're actually becoming a church, whether you realize it or not. Talk about that.
Well, I just think there's something really sacred that happens in the sharing of pain. And even when people say, and I think it's a truthful statement, you know, I never experienced anything as holy as what I did when I got to AA. Well, I think that's, you know, I think in essence, that's what church really is. That's God communing with humans. I think when people are really broken open to each other, there's nothing more sacred than that. Like, let's build a temple here. There's and I think that's certainly what church proper is intended to be. But I think in reality, whenever anybody has a community with other humans where they share the depth of their sorrow on some level, then there's something deeply spiritual about that, whether people intend it to be or not. So you don't have to, whether or not you pray a prayer, whether or not you invite Jesus into the proceedings or the Holy Spirit or like whatever, I think it just happens. There is something fundamentally human and that's so deep and powerful about sharing pain with another person that I think transcends any of the language that we have around those experiences, which is why, you know, I'd be quick to say, no matter what people would identify about God or not, with, you know, if they have a relationship where they're able to share pain in that way, then of course it's going to be holy. And of course there's going to be things that happen there that are going to be really and deeply sacred. And weirdly enough, you know, some people will find that in a bar rather than at church. And I would be the last one to say that what happens inside the, you know, the sanctioned sacred space is somehow more holy than what happens in the bar. I think that, you know, I just think that's very real.
Absolutely. I'm down for some pub theology. So
we do a lot of that here.
I wouldn't say that. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think back to a lot of the really kind of religious conversations that I've had that were the most meaningful. I think there's something about, you know, you just kind of get relaxed in that type of environment, you know, and I can't tell you how many incredible conversations I've had with folks about faith that were shared over a beer or something, you know. So, I get that. One of my other favorite quotes in the book is where you say, love does not need a permission slip to follow you into the heart of darkness, that you can choose whatever path you need to, wherever it may lead you, but you can't choose to walk it alone no matter how hard you try. And I think this goes back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier, where there's nowhere you can go that God won't journey with you and through whatever your experience is.
Yeah, that's right. I don't think I've ever had this thought before this moment, so maybe it's dangerous to pile it now, but I think before there's a way that I would have articulated that to be a Christian is to believe that I'm not alone as a follower of Jesus. And I think part of what shifted is that now for me to be a Christian is to believe that nobody's alone. I don't think anybody's alone. So, and again, that's not imposing Jesus on everybody. Everybody has to have this faith way, but I believe it. I believe that nobody walks alone. And I think, I just find that to be unbelievably like such a source of comfort. And it's the reason, I mean, it's what's so at the heart of everything this book for me is that I feel like all these experiences of disillusionment and being alienated from a community just make you feel so lonely. You're just adrift in your head. Mm. Who do I talk to? People, you don't just kind of make yourself feel like a freak. Other people really make you feel that way. They make you feel like something's wrong with you. And I just, gosh, that feeling that like there's something fundamentally flawed about me to where I'm maybe somehow ultimately rejected. It's just such a passion of mine for people to get to a place where they can really see like, no, like you are, God is fully present wherever you are on this journey, whatever you're thinking about God or whatever you're thinking about stuff, you're not doing any of that alienated. None of that's happening alone.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes. So doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Yeah, and such a big component of that is community and finding a safe community. And maybe, you know, that what that looks like is you have some non-Christian friends who are open enough to allow you to express those thoughts and feelings and be vulnerable in a Starbucks versus going to church. And I can't tell you the amount of people, the number one question that we've gotten over the 6 years of doing this podcast is coming from a lot of folks who are in areas of the country where maybe they live in a smaller town. And so it's harder for them to find a community after leaving the initial community. And so I don't often have an answer for that because, you know, I live in a fairly large city. And so it's fairly easy for me to find people in a similar place and have conversations with them about it. But if you're living in a town that's population 6,000, you know, that community just may not exist. So what do you tell people when they're feeling that isolation and don't have a community within arm's reach?
Well, I can tell you this. I tell them something different than what I used to would have told them, because I think there was a time when I was much more a purist about, well, you know, face to face and bodies, embodied, like, hey, and all of that is great. But I think realistically, and I know the pandemic has deepened this reality, but one of the things I've learned so much from people that I love who are disabled is I am never again going to speak dismissively about the miracles that happen over the internet. The internet is used for a lot of evil. White supremacists find each other, you know, the Klan finds each other, like whatever, it's all true. But at the same time, I really do believe that miracles happen every day over the internet. And that's something I'm eternally grateful for at this point, is that if people absolutely cannot find another soul in that small Arkansas town that they can talk to, then the internet is so freaking niche, you know, it's niche, not like Nietzsche the flood, but every niche it's represented, like, then you're going to find somebody who feels the things that you feel, struggles with things that you struggle with. And I think that's so important. So I think, you know, so I really, at this point, I would always say, like, community, wherever you can find it, in whatever form and whatever source. Now, that being said, you know, I think sometimes, you do need a hug, and there is something about presence that's so, I mean, I think it feels different kinds of needs, but goodness, if you can, through Zoom or a text thread or whatever, feel a little more seen and known, then, like, run to that. I just think it's so important. And especially through the pandemic, we've seen our little community. I really wondered, because we had only existed for about a year before the pandemic hit. And I've been so surprised that our community is much closer than we've ever been, not only hung together, but got much stronger even while we weren't together face to face. So pretty much shot down all my theories about how, like, without that kind of connection, then the bonds aren't as tight. I just don't think that's true anymore.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think just the technology that we have, so fortunate. I feel so fortunate that we had this technology in our hands when the pandemic hit. You know, I think back to, like, when was the last pandemic? 1918. Yeah. I thought, what in the world did they do? You know, just a lot of reading. But, like, that sense of isolation was kind of, you could supplement some of that through Zoom and FaceTime and stuff like that. And so I always tell people, I'm like, hey, I don't have an answer for you, but, you know, you're more than welcome to go to our Facebook page and post up on there and say, hey, is there anybody in this area? Or, like, try to make connections with like-minded people through there. I absolutely, I think that's one of the good parts about the internet.
Yeah, for all the ills.
One of the things I also found interesting in the book is you talk about the fact that faith doesn't change the experience of being human. It doesn't protect us from, you know, the trials and tribulations that come along with being alive. So talk about that a little bit, because I think that's so true.
If that is not a controversial statement to anybody else, it is still a controversial statement to me. And so it's interesting how much even hearing that back, even though it's something I think I changed my mind about a long time ago, that it still was like, well, yeah, like, oh, I guess I did say that. I believe it, but it's still because, and I come from a Pentecostal background, which isn't quite the same as, I really don't come from, like, word of faith exactly, but I still think all of us in more Pentecostal charismatic circles, there is kind of this underlining idea that if you pray hard enough, fast enough, you know, being able to change God, change outcomes, et cetera. And in some weird cosmic way that I don't entirely understand, I really do believe that there are strange ways that people lean into spiritual practices, and I don't know, or set an intention, whatever. It's not that I don't think anything can ever be changed, but I'm quite certain at this point that whether or not you have a certain faith system does not raise or lower your risk of cancer, car accident, divorce, for that matter. It doesn't bear out. It's not true. It's just not true. You're not. So I feel like what faith gives us is it gives us resources and tools to help us interpret our experiences, can give us comfort through our experiences. But the idea that somehow we're going to experience life fundamentally differently than anybody else will. Now, you know, maybe there's subtle ways that's different in the sense that, like, yes, I do think there's plenty of study around the fact that, you know, if you approach life, say, with more positivity, I know that's beneficial for your health. So probably to believe in something is better than to not believe in anything, you know, because if you know, if you're a nihilist, then probably you're, the anxiety affects you over time, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But I just think at the end of the day, there's just really nothing to be sold and bought about to believe about God that really offers a like a qualitatively different kind of life. So I think if we could like level that playing field, which what makes that really sad is that so often that's how various forms of Christianity are sold. The reason you would become a Christian is because you get to, you're going to be happy, you're going to be healthy, you're going to be all these kind of things that I just think we're not guaranteed. And then what happens inevitably is that when things don't turn out that way, people either assume that there's something deeply wrong with them, which is usually what happens. They think there's something wrong with them, or there's something really wrong with God. And God, and again, I'm always okay if people need to reject faith, but I just think oftentimes people are really set up for failure there, because if you're told God is like kind of Santa and this is how the slot machine works, and then it doesn't turn out that way. Well, yeah, yeah, well, of course we're going to be like really bitter at God, because we're told that so long as you pay tithes, nothing bad is going to happen to you, right? So,
yeah, I mean, it kind of goes back to the prosperity gospel. This notion that through a life of faith that you'll be rewarded, yes, with riches, and your life will be easy and comfortable. And it's like the Bible does not reflect that, and nor do the stories in the Bible. There's a lot of suffering and a lot of pain and a lot of anguish and a lot of, you know, you look at Job, you know, like, why God? Like, come on. Like, and it always boils back to that question that you know, people have asked for generations, like, why does bad stuff happen to good people? You know,
that's right.
But I think you're right, you know, in the sense that it doesn't fundamentally change the life experience, but it does change the way in which we look at things when they happen, and how we process them, and how we deal with them, and how we rally around others who are less fortunate, you know, in a time of need. I love that. You hit on something I think that we've talked about on the podcast many, many times, and I know Adam and I say this all the time, and you talk about it in the book, and I think it's a really important thing, and you even really emphasize it. It's this idea that you cannot force someone onto the path, and the way you say, you cannot dictate their journey, and I think that is so true. I think it's only when the individual is ready, and when they're willing to kind of embrace the journey, but you absolutely cannot take someone's journey for them, and you cannot force them onto the path.
Yeah. I think about that all the time, because I feel like, and I'm not impugning anybody's motives here actually, but people just often have elders in their lives who, even if they mean well, tell them what to do. And then I think a lot of us, especially when we don't know what to do, we're drawn to try to find voices with a lot of certainty who are going to tell us, here's what you're supposed to do. When in reality, and I think this really, really bears out in scripture, wise elders never do that. I mean, for me, the height of it, I think about it all the time in this context, is the story of the prodigal son. Like, you know, a good elder is going to give you the keys to the car, even if they think you might wreck it. Like, he gives his son his inheritance early, knowing it's going to, good and well, it's going to be misspent, but that's not his decision to make. And I just think, you know, again, without impugning anybody's motives, that's always, for me, that it's really almost the only indicator. I don't know if there are like 15 others. It's kind of the line to me as to whether or not a culture or a theology is toxic or not. Are people trying to tell you what to do? If people try to take your sense of agency from you, then it can't be good, even if the things they're telling you to do are good. On the other hand, if people legitimately don't try to coerce you and, you know, and actually value your own expression, your own journey, and you're not backed into corners, you're not shamed, if you do things differently, yeah, then that's probably, you know, there's a right and a wrong way to do almost anything. And all kinds of cultures, they can be healthy when people are given room. But if they're not, then even if there are things about the message that are good, I just don't think there's any way that kind of community or that kind of leader, that kind of elder can be good for us.
Yeah. And it makes me think of kind of, you know, getting healthy from like an addiction. You know, addiction counselors always talk about the fact that it almost never sticks when the person is forced into like rehabilitation versus when they're saying, hey, I need help, I'm ready to do this. You know, it made me think of that. So talk about, you talk about the pain that accompanies the journey as something that is not only very real, but that it can feel like a death. And I love this idea because, again, it kind of takes me back to kind of the hero's journey and the death and rebirth kind of symbolism. So talk about death as an essential part of the process.
Ooh. You know, I wish it wasn't as essential. I wish I didn't, sometimes I didn't see this the way that I do. But at this point, I see death and resurrection in everything. And I so deeply believe that there is no resurrection without death. Death is a passageway. Death is the way to the other side. And unfortunately, I think oftentimes the reason that we don't get to rebirth is that we're not able to let go of things that really are dead and dying. So, and I think that that's counterintuitive, especially when you've already lost a lot. Then, now I can't afford to lose this relationship too. If I already feel like I've lost 80%, I can't lose the last 20. Actually, let go of the last 20 and going all the way, like embracing full descent. Ooh, I think so often is what the path to freedom looks like. But I mean, that's oftentimes just stepping into the free fall. And without trying to go into a whole nother thing, this came to me, and I will use that word here, in a truly revelatory way. There was a book that was given to me in a time when I needed most, Catherine Dowling Singh's book, The Grace in Dying, which she was a PhD hospice worker, but her whole view on dying is grace, and how, whether it's for a short period or a long period, that when people, if they are given time to die, as opposed to like a sudden tragic death, that there's always some period of freedom. Again, it might not be for a long time for everybody, but sometimes it is. But like this, once you get past all the ego stuff of, I can't believe my body's shutting down and betraying me and people have to take care of it and it's embarrassing, that once you get past, and I've just really believed now that that principle is true in every part of our lives, is that if you can get through the ego death, then who, and it's the reason why, and I still don't want this to be true, that oftentimes I think what's going to feel like redemption is often on the other side of what we're going to experience as humiliation. What if people knew this or like whatever? Well, would suck, but oftentimes what we really find is that's where the freedom and healing comes, is when things come into the light in this way, because that ego death happens where there's now the opportunity for rebirth. So, and the point is not to say, like in the book, that, okay, you have to, that hasn't happened for me. You have to let go of, you have to murder everything about your belief system before, but at the same time, I will say that I do think it's important, and that's definitely borne out in my life. I think I had to get to a place almost Abraham and Isaac style. Like I was willing to let it all, like, okay, I'm not holding on to anything just based on some sort of ritualistic or like it's just comfort food or something. I'm willing to go wherever it takes, wherever this journey is authentically leading me. I'm not going to be dishonest with myself about what the answers are. I think you do have to get to that place. And that if you have any sort of belief system at all and go through some kind of an unraveling, I think getting to that place is going to be a kind of death.
Absolutely. I think a lot of the listeners probably are nodding their heads right now in agreement that it, you know, oftentimes, like we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, you know, it often comes with a lot of other things attached to it. It's not just the loss of your beliefs, but oftentimes loss of community. And that can feel like a complete life disruption and a massive death in a way. One of the things you say in the book that I really found interesting is you talk about the idea that we can believe in God only to the extent that we can believe in others. Explain what you mean by that. I thought that was really neat.
Well, I found it so instructive. I think I use this quote too, which is one I use a lot, but I go back to it all the time. Rowan Williams from years ago, I think it's in his book, Tokens of Trust, about how certain people create for us a world that we'd like to live in. We can see in them a world that we'd like to live in, or could imagine ourselves on our better days, better moments, however he puts it, living in. I've just come to really believe that that's true, that it's only to the extent that we can see in a body, in an embodied life, what God looks like. That's going to be the limit for us. Now, at the same time, I guess I technically believe that God goes beyond the boundaries of the nicest person that I know or most forgiving person I know or something like that. But I still think, you know, I'm only going to have the capacity to believe that God is better, kinder, more loving, more gracious, whatever, than the best people that I know. And part of what I do actually in that chapter, and while again, I'm said the book is not apologetics or something because I just don't care about anything like that. It is me kind of stacking the deck in terms of, you know, why do I believe? Why do I still believe? Why do I care at all? Well, it's because of these people. And I talk about a few of those people. I talk about Otis Moss III, pastor of Trinity United Church in Chicago. I talk about Sister Margaret Gaines. She's not with us anymore, but this sweet Church of God missionary to Palestinian people who changed my life. I talk about these saints who've been that for me. And I still do believe that that's true, that it's only to the extent that we actually see this kind of goodness in the lives of others, that we even have the capacity to believe in a God who's good in that way, which also, by the way, unfortunately, I think worked in the opposite direction. I think that if you're in a belief system where the people around you are frankly petty and vindictive and small, pretty difficult to imagine in a God that's not petty and vindictive and small. And I do think a lot of people within their particular sphere, that might be their experience for a long time. That even people might on some fundamental level, like be good. They're sort of not allowed. Their theology doesn't really allow them to be, you know? And that's hard.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. We've talked about for a long time about the idea that, so often, and you talk about this in the book as well, like talking about people who, are rejecting this idea of God that, you know, you yourself would also reject. You're like, no, it's this idea of God that probably reflects more that person's ideology and that person's beliefs, more than the nature of God, itself. And so, you know, a lot of times I find myself saying, as they're describing to me this version of God, I'm like, yeah, I just don't believe that version of God either. I wouldn't want to follow a Christianity that believed that either. Fortunately, I don't. I believe in a loving God and, you know, a very different idea. But one of the last questions I want to ask you, just because I think this is one that comes up, and Adam and I have warned against this for a long time, and we've tried to structure our podcast in a way where we want the guests to be front and center and be able to present their ideas and not have us be the highlight, you know what I mean, of the podcast, because we've said for a long time, like, look, we are certainly no experts. And we've tried to warn against this idea of swapping one quote expert for another quote expert. And so we find that a lot of people coming out who are very jaded and disillusioned from this form of Christianity that they were born and raised in, perhaps, just latching on to another so-called expert, and really creating a type of fundamentalism on the other end of the spectrum. Yeah. And so you talk about trusted guides in the book. So how do you avoid falling into the same kind of pattern again? Because it's very easy.
I think I have a lot of thoughts, but I think the biggest one is in the moment, is I think what often happens is we're so drawn to certainty that certainty is as appealing to us from one direction or the other. And unfortunately, what I find is that in the same way that this is, I feel like within, for most of our listeners, this is just not going to be controversial. So here we'll like say, use a name. So if like, say like John Piper, if the appeal of John Piper on one side is that he's really, really certain about everything. So you've got such a kind of everything's black or white in or out, like everything, it's just such a rigid, just so certain. I get legitimately concerned when people leave a faith system and the way they speak about everything is just as certain as it was before. And it's surprising sometimes that people can't tell the difference. Oh, that's the same tone of voice you got before. That's the same rigid. There's still insiders and outsiders. There's still good guys and bad guys. There's still huge assumptions made about people that you may not know well. There's still tons of doctrinal purity codes. There's still ideological purity codes. If you differ from us on sanctification, then you're not part of our group. Well, now what if you're in a whole different world, but you do differ a little bit politically or theologically or whatever? Are you now not allowed in that space? Because if so, like I think that might be worth asking some really critical questions. I do feel like, unfortunately, because we have such an intense desire to belong, that's always going to make us circle around communities where there is a clear sense of insiders and outsiders. Because how do we know that we're us? Because there's a them. That's how we know. How do we know that we're the insiders? Because we have outsiders. So I guess that would be my biggest thing, though, is just like recognizing, like, when we hear people speak with a lot of certainty and a lot of rigidity. I also, quite frankly, I don't know if I've ever said this quite this way in a conversation like this, but I really do believe it. I don't trust any kind of theology or philosophy in any direction where people are irredeemable. I just don't. I didn't then, and I don't now. And it messes with my head that, like, in the name of some sort of enlightenment or something, that you still have people who are irredeemably bad for whom there is no sort of like grace. I just think if that is the kind of world we live in, we don't have a benevolent God, we don't have a benevolent universe, and I'm ready to check out if people aren't capable of growth, transformation, and change in some way. That's what fundamentalism told me that. Some people they've gone too far and they're beyond the realm of God's grace or something. If I still have to be in a world where people can't change or grow, I'm like, what's the point?
Yeah, it's funny. It makes me think of a conversation I was having the other night with a friend of mine, and we were just talking about the nature of being human, and the fact that this message that's so prevalent in so many Christian streams is this idea that you are born this flawed human being, and it's like, well, that wasn't my fault, right? at that point. I'd be looking at God like, well, why did you make me flawed knowing that I was going to do something stupid, And then now you're punishing me for the thing that you knew I was probably going to do. And it just seems like there's something inherently wrong with that, where the blame is placed on us and yet we're doing as we're programmed.
That's right. That's right. And John, this is such a great conversation. I love all of this so much because I think that even touched on something important, because even though I would not articulate a belief in original sin the way that I used to in this highly Augustinian kind of manner. Well, and it's where sometimes I'm not maybe as squeamish as some people would be about having any kind of language of sin at all. It's like the same time, well, we do all come into the world in which there are systems, structures that we participate in, some that we willfully choose and some that we do not. And now that doesn't mean we don't have to take responsibility for them, but we become more aware of them over time, like as we go. So I just think so all that just becomes more and more nuanced for me. It's like, we're all learning, okay, here are ways that I might have participated in some of these broader realities and some of these systemic things that may not have been entirely. So now, again, that's not the same thing as you're born naughty and God's sending you to hell for yourself, which I think is very unhealthy. But I think the idea that sometimes we do participate in things that aren't necessarily like fully consciously chosen, you know, is like, is somehow true. And where, again, it's still, it's so strange to me when then people aren't given room to like change or grow. It's like, yeah, well, people, you know, like how often have we seen people perpetuate the same kind of mistakes or cycles? Cause they just didn't know better. That's what they were given. Not cause God consigned them to a life of like, you know, doom or whatever, but it's just, you know, it's just all that they knew. So that for me is what I love about the Jesus story so much, is that there's always room to break any kind of cycle. You, no one is ever consigned to some kind of fate because of what your parents did or because of something you did 20 years ago, like whatever. Like there's always hope that a new and different kind of life could happen in the midst of whatever, for whoever. And that for me is just incredibly beautiful.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I think it, you know, to think otherwise is to ignore how nuanced and complex being a human being is. You know, it's never as simple when you hear, you know, somebody committed this horrific crime. It's never so simple as, well, they're just bad. You know, as more information comes out, there's always something like, well, this person was horrifically abused their entire childhood. You know, and there's always some sort of backstory that adds this level of complexity that is just being human. That's part of the human story, as we are very complex, and there is a lot of nuance in being a human being and being alive.
You know, we here in Oklahoma, I mean, one of the things that's kind of been consuming the last couple of years, Julius Jones, who from afar has been such a friend, and his family, you know, Antoinette, his mom, and I'm sorry, Madeline, his mom, and Antoinette's sister, been so connected to the table. We love them, and C.C. Jones Davis, and this whole like fight for Julius Jones has been so central. And of course, we were grateful that he wasn't executed, but at the same time, he's still in prison, and there's a lot I could say about that. But in this whole thing about criminal justice reform, which has become such a passion of mine and such a passion for our community, I've thought about that long and hard for kind of a long time. And it's interesting now how, for the first time, I'm starting to think about other things now in light of it, because before I was with evangelical people who were not willing to think critically about their faith and the death penalty. Now that I've been more with people for a while who think this way about the death penalty, now I'm starting to think, okay, well, if you think that no one should be consigned to death because of, you know, like of something in their past, there's always, you believe in this kind of mercy or whatever, it'd be pretty weird to believe that other people should be utterly, completely written off with no chance of like parole or like whatever while they're still alive. But I think that's possible. Like, you could become the kind of person who says like, well, technically you're like, well, I don't believe in the death penalty, but I do believe that some people are like past redemption. That to me is like, is an equally weird, you know, inconsistent ethic of life. So I don't know. It's just, it's interesting how now that's starting to work the other direction in how I think about things.
Yeah. That's so true. I know we're getting to the end here, but the last question I want to ask you, because I think this is a good place to land, because this is a very important thing to me. It's where you talk about the symbolism and the symbolic nature behind this common theme that you see in the Bible, which is the act of eating and drinking and sharing a table with others. Talk about that.
Well, it's interesting how, you know, I think for a lot of us, the faith that we came into was so, it was all ideas. It's all propositional. And at this point, I believe in the Apostles' Creed. I like the Apostles' Creed. I'm happy to say that. But I still think what that has come to mean for many of us is faith as ideas. And I just think at its core, Christianity has never really been a set of ideas. It's much more so a set of practices. And specifically, it's the meal. And that for me is just simplified so much. What we do at the table with our, you know, little community here in Oklahoma City, it's very much like, you know, whatever you think about God today, we're inviting you to come here to the table for us. And that's so much more important than what you affirm or don't affirm in terms of giving intellectual assent to things. not unlike kind of the whole thing about how what you believe about God doesn't necessarily change what you're going to experience in your life. I certainly feel that way about how we encounter the grace of God through the table. And I think it's, so I just love kind of getting away from this idea of faith mostly as a set of propositions or a set of ideas, and much more so, no, this is bread and wine. This is something that you do. It's something that you do with others. It's something you can taste. It's something that's tactile. It's something that's real. And it actually gets us out of our heads. That's one of the reasons, I think, ultimately, even if we don't always name it that way, a lot of us have ended up on some of the kind of journeys that we've been on, is I think in some form or another, we saw that changing our minds about all these things and coming, even getting maybe sometimes really complex kind of theological systems didn't really make that big of a difference in our lives or the lives of people around us. We weren't happier. The people around us weren't happier. We weren't loving our neighbors or even ourselves any better. Just didn't really make that big of a difference. On the other hand, though, I think that this practice of hospitality, both being on the receiving end of it and giving in this way, oh, yeah, I think that changes our lives. I think that changes the world. So it's, you know, for me, it's not even like this kind of, I don't mean it to be like syrupy and sentimental, like, oh, yeah, like, you know, you open yourself to someone else. Like, no, I mean, I think it's like objectively true. I think that actually changes the world, like in ways that are demonstrably true, in ways that changing our mind about things just doesn't. So now it's really no wonder that Jesus makes this meal the center of everything, because I think no wonder that the table practice of Jesus is the central scandal of Jesus in the Gospels, which I still to this minute find it so weird that no one ever seems to connect. I feel like I never hear that connected in preaching. Everybody just seems to leave that alone. It's like as if the table practice of Jesus that was so scandalous wasn't meant to directly inform the table practice of the church. Jesus is primarily known and is primarily a scandal because of his inclusive table practice. But the church, on the other hand, has to be highly selective, and you have to be baptized and gone through a class and all these steps in order to be able to come to the table. Like, I still feel like that's such a fundamental disconnect in how we understand those texts.
That's so funny. So I just went back to church for the first time last weekend since the pandemic. Yeah. So we were kind of, my daughter and I were kind of looking around for a new church. We had moved and to a different part of town and stuff. So we had just started the process before everything shut down. And so last weekend I went to a church that I'd been to before that I really liked. And I had just had a conversation, I think with my parents, about the fact that, you know, being born and raised Lutheran, a lot of people don't know there's different variations of Lutheran, right? There's ELCA Lutheran, which we are. There's Missouri Synod Lutheran. There's even Wisconsin Synod Lutheran. And they vary in the way in which they kind of view things. And from what you might call hyper-conservative to all the way to the other extreme. And so as an ELCA Lutheran, we've always been very, very open about communion and the table, as it were, versus Missouri Synod, which a lot of our family, extended family members are. And I remember as a kid, we would go to visit them and go to their church. And everything was the same until you got to the point where you went up for communion. And if you weren't Missouri Synod, you weren't allowed to take communion. And I always thought that was so strange. I'm like, who are you to deny me, you know, like the Lord's Supper? And so we went to church for the first time in a while last weekend. And I had been talking to my girlfriend about it, and she's not a huge church goer. Mm-hmm. She's has some, you know, some trauma from the past, so understandably. And I kept telling her that. I said, trust me, there are, not all churches are the same, number one. And number two, there are churches out there who I think will fall on the right side of history, who are accepting, and when they say all are welcome, they mean all are welcome. And so we went, and the first two images that popped up, number one, they were teaching a class where they partnered with the this local LGBTQ plus organization to explain exactly what those letters and the acronyms mean for folks, and indicated that we are fully affirming church, and when we mean all are welcome, all are welcome. And so that was a good check mark for her. And then the second thing that happened was when it came time to take communion, he said, we believe that no matter what your background is and what you believe and where you're from, you're welcome at the Lord's table. And I thought, that's what's up. Yes. You know, I thought, who are we to dictate who's allowed at the table? Everyone should be allowed.
And I love that. I'm so grateful that y'all had that experience. That's so beautiful. It's always so encouraging for me to hear. To me, it just underscores why. And it's, there's a beautiful simplicity to it, you know, like, and it's part of, to me, of the genius of Jesus and the Jesus story and why I still care about any of this is I think, you know, I just don't know anything but the table that's able to do that. I think it's precisely because it isn't a set of ideas. It's like, no, if you want to come and drink, eat and drink with us, then come on down. That for me is what makes all of that possible in a way that any sort of lineup of the ideas just doesn't do it. Because I think even if it's more like have inclusive ideas, but it's not, it you know, come down to the same table, drink from the same cup, eat from the same loaf, receive at the same time. Like I think there's something about that just levels us in a way that's like really, really fundamental. And when a church is like really clear about that, when that's the main event, it does set an agenda. It does set an agenda for the community. The table has an agenda. The table is an agenda. You know, that's really wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to what you talk about in the book is what it did for her. And I had no expectations that after this experience, I think she was probably humoring me for Easter, you know, like, sure, John, we'll go to church. I'll humor you. And so I think it probably started in that place, but then what instantly happened, and this is all credit to, I should probably give him a shout out, Peace Lutheran in church in Gahanna. What immediately happened is exactly what you talk about in the book is it created a sense of safety for her and she felt safe in that environment. And I was honestly shocked and kind of a little overjoyed at the end where we got back in the car and she said, that was really good. I would do that again. I would like to go back again. And I thought that I was not asking for that. I was not expecting that, but it all goes back to the fact that in her prior experiences, she felt very unsafe and not welcomed and not included. And in this space she did, and that made the difference.
That's just so beautiful. I'm so glad that you told me that story. I love to hear these kind of stories and I love for them to be told. And one of the reasons, I don't mean this on a down note, but I feel like in the moment, it can feel like that those narratives aren't the ones that are winning because oftentimes truth be told, rigid ideologies work. I mean, for marketing purposes, because people do want certainty. They're drawn to it. Having communities that are inclusive, it's messier. It's more difficult to pull off when you allow people to really be where they are and you allow gender and race and all that kind of stuff, but ideological diversity of all sorts. And you're not telling everybody they have to think the same way. It's just a messier process. And so I think oftentimes what, you know, the way that gets interpreted is, well, though obviously God is not blessing those communities the way God is blessing these communities because the numbers are not as strong. When in reality, I think it's really, I've come to see it so opposite. I'm like, well, I think the reason that oftentimes these communities struggle more is because this is really what the narrow way of Jesus looks like. It's not one of judgment, but it is one of inclusion. It's a harder way to live, like truly welcoming and like fully allowing people to bring their whole selves to a community without needing to censor that is much harder work than the other way. But I think people still have it embedded in their heads, you know, this kind of like, no, you know, these ideas about holiness and being tougher on sin or like whatever, like that's, you know, that's the Jesus way. That's the narrow way. I just don't think that's true.
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. And all you have to do is look at the number of mega churches, like certainty sells, ambiguity does not. You know, people don't like to go somewhere and see someone at the forefront and have them say, you know what? I don't know. Like they want an answer in the moment. And I think, you know, you probably agree and be, you know, and probably in a similar place where I actually like that too. Now. I like the fact that somebody can honestly look at me and say, you know what? Like, we've been arguing about this for centuries, and I honestly don't know. That's a good question. I'm like, oh, there's some genuine honesty in that.
That takes a lot of courage to do. Yeah, I just don't. It's hard at this point. Again, I just it's funny how now, instead of starting to be the thing that draws me, the way I think is true for all of us, it's especially certain stages of life, we're drawn to certainty. It's the opposite for me. Like, if I hear certainty, it's like, okay, well, this is definitely not a place that I want, that I want to be. Whatever it is, if you're too certain about it, that I don't want what you're selling, because it's like, it makes me nervous. I just think that certainty is not good for the world. I think certainty is not... is not how God is. Nuance and loving people as they are. Yeah, it is more complicated and it is more demanding, but I think it's more right and it's more true and more beautiful. And that's the way I want to go. But I think that involves a lot more I don't knows. So,
yeah. Amen to that. I think that's probably the best place to end. I could absolutely go on for another 2 hours, but I think we'd start losing listeners at that point. So that'll just give us more to talk about next time. But as always, this was an absolute blast. Thank you so much for coming back on.
Thank you for having me. Such an honor and truly a wonderful conversation. This has been so good for my soul. So thank you.
Same. Well, before I let you go, tell people again, the book is The Road Away from God, How Love Finds Us Even As We Walk Away. Tell people, how can they stay up on top of what you're up to and where do they go? When does the book come out, I guess? That's the other question.
The book comes out on June 7th, Road Away from God. So June 7th from Baker, should be available everywhere. So I know Baker through their bookstore has it, I think, for 40% off right now, but certainly on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, like wherever it is that you buy books. You can find me on Jonathan A. Martin on Instagram. I'm trying to come back onto Twitter. I haven't tweeted in too long, but at the boy on the bike, JonathanMartinWords.com is my website. In those places, would be happy to catch up with folks.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And always a pleasure.
So good to be here. On.